Welcome to Nobody Told Me. I'm Jan Black.
And I'm Laura Owens.
What motivates people? Our guest has spent a lot of time studying that question and writing about it. Our guest is E. Scott Geller, a behavioral psychologist and alumni distinguished professor of psychology at Virginia Tech. He specializes in studying the development of behavior change interventions to improve quality of life.
Professor, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's my pleasure. Thank you.
I think I've told just about everybody that your TED Talk is probably my favorite of all time. You have the most engaging voice, and
it's
fantastic. And I watch a lot of TED Talks. I'm sure my mom can attest
to
that.
She does. So she does, yes.
We were very excited to get your yes answer to our interview.
You make my day. I'm a teacher and I'm a researcher, but all of this stuff means nothing if it doesn't get to the public. There's so much pop psychology out there that is totally wrong, and it's been bothering me. I've been a professor now for 49 years, and I've been hearing this stuff out there that's not based on psychological science. It's based on somebody's common sense, and so I'm thrilled to know that I have this opportunity. Many of the TED Talks, for example, they don't reference any research. In fact, it's not based on research. It's based on somebody's common sense, somebody's bias, somebody's bias. And anyway, I'm pleased that I have an opportunity to share some psychological science with your listeners.
Well, you have such a vast area of expertise, and I'm wondering what got you interested in studying behavior.
Well, it is all about behavior from my perspective. See, I started out as a cognitive psychologist, but I wanted to make a difference. My mission in life, in research and education, is to make a difference. Now, this is not to demean cognitive psychology, but for me, I wasn't making a difference. I realized if we want to save the environment, if we want to improve quality of life, we need to change or improve behavior. So that turned me to behavioral science, and that's really what I've been focusing my scholarship and research on for several years. We have a movement we call Actively Caring for People. In fact, there's a website, activelycaringpeople.org. And this website started back in 2007 when we had that terrible tragedy everybody knows about at Virginia Tech, April 16th, when 32 faculty and students were shot. After that time, we said, you know, we need to get the Actively Caring for People movement bigger. And so that's what we've got. So maybe your listeners might be interested in log on to activelycaringpeople.org and learn more about what is it about, or what can we do to spread actively caring. Now notice, actively caring, I call it humanistic behaviorism. I call it using the principles of behavioral science to improve welfare. But people need to accept those principles and use those principles, and that takes humanism.
Okay, now what are those principles?
Oh, goodness. Yeah, well, there's seven. I've just written, I have a book now that talks about seven basic principles. And I've written a book for police officers, and I've written a book for school teachers, and I've written the book for safety professionals. So these are seven basic principles that I think the world needs to understand. And it's based on science. I mean, the first principle is focus on positive consequences. Use more positive consequences to influence behavior. I mean, we are a click it or ticket society. We believe that the best way to change behavior is to pass a law and enforce it. Now, that might be the most efficient way, but you don't improve attitude and behavior at the same time, particularly for the long term. So that's the first principle. Employ more positive consequences. The second principle is benefit from observational learning. You know, we need to understand that people learn by watching us. And if we could just say to ourselves, you know, I can make this world a better place if I set a better example.
All right, thank you.
And this is for everyone. You know, we just don't think enough of the example we're setting for others. So that's observational learning. The number three is we need to improve behavior with feedback. behavioral feedback. And so the whole lesson is about how do you use feedback? You know, if someone came up to you and say, hey, I'd like to give you some feedback, Jan or Laura, what would you say? I mean, would you, oh, no, thank you. Or say, come to my office at the end of the day. I want to give you some feedback. Would your day be ruined? Because I think people don't recognize feedback as the breakfast of champions. I mean, we need feedback to improve. Practice does not make perfect. Practice makes permanence. Only with feedback can we improve. But we have to learn how to give feedback, like supportive feedback or corrective feedback. They're very different. Mm-hmm. Supportive feedback is easy. We're very direct. We tell the person what you saw that you appreciate, and you thank them. By the way, when you give supportive feedback, I call that a now that reward. Now that you've done that, I want to reward you with some words of praise. That increases the individual's sense of competence. And I'm going to say right now, when people feel more competent at doing worthwhile work, they're more likely to be self-motivated. So supportive feedback not only improves behavior and supports behavior, it increases the perception of competence. Now, corrective feedback is very different. You see a person made an error and you want to correct them. How do you give corrective feedback? Well, here's the humanism in this. You're not directive. You're non-directive. You know, you say, hey, why did you do it that way? I mean, I'm in the field of safety, and you can say, hey, you did that unsafe. What's wrong with you? No, that's not the way you give the kind of corrective feedback so the individual accepts it. You have to say, hey, is there a better way to do the job? Or is there something we could talk about to make the job safer? So it's about getting people to own up to their behavior that could be improved. So that's corrective feedback. And like I say, the books written for different audiences really go into detail about how you do that correctly. So, and then lesson four, use more supportive feedback than corrective feedback. Mm-hmm. You know, we had this common sense word. Have you heard this word, constructive criticism?
Oh, exactly. Yeah. Yes.
Well, you know, guess how wrong that is. First, criticism cannot be constructive, you know? Criticism is destructive. And when you give feedback, in this case, it would be corrective feedback, you have to give it in such a way that the person is okay, you know? They feel okay about it. They realize you're trying to help them and you're non-directive. So that's the fourth lesson. Then we get to lesson five, and now I'm getting into humanism. So those first four lessons, and by the way, I'm calling them now life lessons. Those first four life lessons are all about behavioral science. And there's so much research to say, when you do it this way, when you give more positive consequences, when you recognize the power of observational learning, when you give more supportive feedback than corrective feedback, and you do it right, people improve, not only their behavior, but their attitudes. But now we move into humanism. Lesson five, embrace and practice empathy. Now, we've heard the word empathy. We know what that means.
Sure.
But sometimes we don't practice it. You know, empathy is realizing or putting yourself in the other person's shoes. When you give corrective feedback, for example, how about first looking and trying to understand, if I were in that situation, might I have made that same mistake? Might I have been risky? So empathy means trying to see it from the other person's situation. And you can't do this with email, with text messaging. This takes one-on-one conversation. And of course, the books describe exactly how do you do that. You know, listening has five levels. The very bottom is we ignore. We're not ignored. Then sometimes we pretend, you know, and then most of the listening we do is selective. Confirmation bias, they're calling it this day. I mean, listen to CNN News and then listen to Fox News, and you see total different perspectives. And these people who are talking on these news stations, they believe what they say. We call it selective perception. Here's a point, however. The term selective perception, it's redundant because all perception is selective. You know, we sense the world through our five senses, mm-hmm. and then we interpret the world, and that's perception. And it's always selective. So that's the issue about listening. Then we move up to active listening. At the very top is empathic listening, when you try to listen from the other person's perspective. And in that part of the book, we talk about the golden rule as not being optimal. Like what is the golden rule, right? It's treat others the way you want to be treated. Mm-hmm. Well, what if that person doesn't want to be treated the way you want to be treated? You know, and so we discuss the platinum rule. With empathy, treat others the way they want to be treated. Find out how they want to be treated. That's a powerful concept. You know, when I was in the third grade, the teacher in front of the whole class recognized me for my homework. Would Scotty please stand up? And I'm so embarrassed. I was shy anyway. But listen, I want the class to know that Scotty Geller did the best job on his homework. And then the kids beat me up in the playground. I didn't want public recognition.
Yeah.
Who does for certain things? Now, the teacher, guess what? She heard that slogan. Perhaps you've heard it. Reprimand privately and recognize publicly. Uh-huh. Right? You've heard that. But that's not always correct. Some people, you recognize me in front of my work team, and they will tease me back at the place. What have you been doing to get the boss to say those kind words about you? You've been cussing up again, Joe? You know? So it's about empathy. It's about seeing it from the other person's perspective. So that is embrace and practice empathy. Now, lesson six is distinguish between managing behavior and leading people. You know, there are managers and there are leaders. And there's nothing wrong with managers. What do managers do? They hold us accountable. They hold us accountable for what we do. And I need people holding me accountable. I mean, you guys manage me today. You told me to get on the phone at this time. And
sure.
There's nothing wrong with that. We manage people. However, leaders, but let me back up. As a teacher, I'm afraid that I'm really nothing more than a manager. You know, I give grades and students come to class for grades. But leaders inspire people to be self-accountable. That's different. That's different. And so let me just share with you, and that's my TEDx talk was all about this. How do we motivate people and ourselves to be self-motivated, self-directed, self-accountable? Well, there's three C words. Remember, there's three C words. One, competence. I already mentioned that one. When people feel more competent at doing worthwhile work, they're more likely to be self-motivated. I mean, we've all been there. You're into a job and you're into the flow and you're feeling good at what you're doing and you're getting perhaps some natural feedback from the work. You see, hey, this looks pretty good. This is coming along great. Shoot, we might miss dinner. You know, we are self-motivated. Now, that's competence. What about choice? Psychologists have shown many, many times, and it makes common sense as I share it with you, that when we believe we have choice, or you call it autonomy, when we believe we chose, at least part of what I'm doing is choice, we're more motivated. And that's why I don't like click or ticket. That's why I don't like top-down mandates. Of course, if we change the word mandate to opportunity, I tell my students, I say, how many came today to avoid failure? 80% raise their hand.
Uh-huh.
And I say, wow, I'm okay. I'm glad you're here. But you probably told your friends, I got to go to class, not I get to go to class.
Right.
You saw this as a requirement, not an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And those words, requirement and mandate, and they come across as depreciating our perception of choice. And again, the more we believe and realize we do have a lot of choice, the more we're likely to be self-motivated. And the last word, I like another C word, community. Psychologists have shown the powerful aspect of our lives that keep us going is social support, relatedness, believing that what we're doing can help others. let's face it, I'm excited about this phone conversation for the thought that you will send this out and other people might listen and benefit, and we're making the world a better place. That's community. We're all in this together. I believe in interdependency, not independency. But I was raised to be independent. You know, I was dependent on my parents to take care of me. Then I became a teenager, and I wanted to do it myself. I can do it myself. Why? How was I raised? Nice guys finish last. The squeaky wheel gets the grease. Mm-hmm. Got to blow your own horn. I mean, we've been raised to be independent. Can I help you? No, I can do it myself. That needs to be turned around. We need to become more interdependent. We need to become systems thinkers. Drivers on the highway, I see them all the time. They're not thinking of the big picture. They're thinking of themselves. They weave in and out of traffic without giving a signal. I mean, they're simply not thinking of the big picture. They're not systems thinkers. They're not thinking of all of us in this together could help each other. Now, finally, the last, and I think the last one connects to all of these. The last one says progress or advance from self-actualization to self-transcendence. Have you ever heard, perhaps you've heard about Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Have you guys heard about that?
No. I'm not familiar with it.
Well, almost every motivational course, almost every teacher, they talk about Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And it's basic. Now, what he essentially says, and although there's not a lot of research supporting it, it sounds so good. That is, we first satisfy our psychological needs, hunger and food, and then when we have those satisfied, we can move on to the next level. And the next level is safe and secure. So, okay, I've got enough food, enough sleep. Now I want to be safe and secure. Now we move up after I feel safe and secure. Now I've got social needs. I want to feel accepted and connected with people. After social needs, we have self-esteem. I feel worthwhile. The last one, and which has been thought as the top, when I ask groups give keynote addresses, I say, what's at the top of Maslow's hierarchy of needs? And they heard it, even in high school, self-actualization, the top of Maslow's hierarchy, self-actualization. What does that mean? Well, my professor back in graduate school told me it means that you've achieved all you wanted to achieve. You've gotten there. You've met your goals and so forth. Then he looked me square in the eye and he said, Geller, I don't think you'll ever get there. And he was right. I don't think I'll ever achieve all I wanted to achieve. But right. Guess what? Maslow passed away in 1970. His last book is called The Farthest Reaches of Human Nature. His wife published his book, and he said he was wrong. He said the top of that hierarchy of needs is not self-actualization, it's self-transcendence. It's going beyond yourself for somebody else. And I bet everybody who's listening in knows that it's a good feeling, is it not, to help somebody else. And if we could just get people to experience that more often, by the way, you don't have to have those other needs satisfied before you reach the top. Mother Teresa didn't. Gandhi didn't. Many people don't have all these other needs satisfied, and yet they're out there helping others. And when you help others, see, we call that actively caring for people. When you reach out and actively care for others, that feeds your self-esteem. You feel better about yourself. That feeds your sense of belongingness, a sense of connection with others. So, indeed, I'm thinking that this last principle, that we have to move from self-actualization to self-transcendence, is really the key to improving quality of life and human nature and well-being.
Right. When I was preparing for this interview, and like I said, I was so, so excited to talk to you, couldn't wait, was fascinated by what your talk was about. I still managed to procrastinate on writing my questions down. I mean, I was still, I had Netflix on in the background. My sister was around and she's talking to me. Sure. My dog is there. Why is it that we have so much trouble motivating ourselves when we're the ones we're hurting in the long run?
Oh, that's a great question. And it's the key to to failure in many ways. Why? It's because of B.F. Skinner. It's what he said, selection by consequences. We are motivated for soon, certain, immediate, positive consequences. So you got your family and the dog and all that good stuff, and man, you want to pay attention to that. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with that, which is simply saying that's what holds us back from doing some of these other things, you know. But but you do have what we call now is EQ, which is emotional intelligence. You can delay immediate consequences. Unlike my dog, by the way, he'll go for the immediate consequences. But people can delay an immediate consequence for a future longer term consequence. But I mean, Jan, you knew you were going to do this. I mean, you knew that you were going to get this done. So you had it planned. And so there were other soon certain positive consequences that you wanted to enjoy. So there's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, that's why we have people overweight. That's why we have people who don't get the job done, because they're distracted by positive consequences. When I talk to my students, by the way, I tell them that they all have a Skinner box in their hand. What do I mean? I mean, B.F. Skinner studied rats in a box, and he studied how rats will push a lever and they'll get food pellet. And he invented and worked on different schedules of reinforcement and studied the rat's behavior. Well, what my students have is a Skinner box, namely a cell phone, a smartphone. And they can't even walk without playing this little smartphone game. You know, we have distracted driving. Well, I claim we have distracted walking. And they go downstairs and they hold up the students behind them because they're punching their little cell phone in their hand. This is the current issue with this generation. And it's all about positive consequences. The same kind of thing that holds us back from longer term, bigger consequences.
How have you seen your students change over the years? You've been doing this, I think you said 49 years. How have they changed?
Wow. Well, now we have less discussion in class. See, I've been teaching introductory psychology all that time, and I have maybe 500 students in the class. But now it's PowerPoint. Now we have a PowerPoint bunch of slides, and they all get copies on their computers. So now the class is not students sitting and watching the lecturer. Now it's students with their laptops open, and they could be on Facebook for all I know, and they're, many of them, they got the lecture right in front of them. So now there's less creativity and less engagement in the classroom than there used to be. But again, they expect this now. They expect to have all the material from the website and such. And now, by the way, now we don't even have, many courses don't even have textbooks. They have online books. By the way, years ago when I was a student, I wanted to own my book, man. I highlighted it and I wrote in that book, and I took notes in the classroom, not on a computer, but didn't have those computers, but I wrote handwritten. And research has shown, by the way, that when people write it by hand, they retain it better than if they punch it on keys on a computer.
Yeah, and it sticks in there better.
It's a different climate, and it's a bigger challenge in many ways to keep their attention, because there's so many distractions. Like I said, that Skinner box that they carry around with all day long, that's clearly a distraction, and it's remarkable. I have to laugh. I actually almost bump into people because they don't even look up to see me coming because they're looking down at their smartphone.
Oh, my gosh. That happens so often.
Sure, yeah.
And unfortunately, I'm guilty of it myself, but, you know, when I see other people do it, I have to admit I get a little bit judgy about it.
And how about a conversation you're having with somebody at the dinner table and people are looking at their cell phone? They're not even engaged in that conversation, and their cell phone rings, and wow, I got to pick that up. I got to see who's there. Mm-hmm. I asked my students, 500. I said, how many besides me do not have their cell phone with them? See, I don't have my cell phone with me. I want to be engaged in the moment.
Uh-huh.
Not a single hand goes up. They all have their cell phone with them in their hands in many cases.
What worries you about that? About us as a society with that focus on cell phones and that kind of reward as opposed to the interpersonal connection?
Oh. Well, remember we talked moments ago about empathy.
Yeah.
About feeling for people, you know, about really seeing who they are. And it's been, this has also been shown in research that that youngsters, that people today are more less empathic. They're connecting less empathically with others. They're more, it's all about a selfie, not a helpie.
Yeah.
we're all into our own worlds, you know, and that's what scares me. That's what scares me.
But you know what? At the same time, though, I think in some ways having Facebook and Instagram and seeing the struggles that my friends go through and being able to support them by liking a status or commenting on something, that kind of makes me feel more empathetic, I think, than if I was going around without my cell phone.
Well, it makes you perceive and feel social support. I'm not sure it allows for empathy, because empathy is really understanding where the other person is coming from. But don't get me wrong, man. I think the internet and cell phone, it's amazing how efficient that communication is. We get more done than ever before with the current system, and very efficient, and we can perceive social support. We can connect to people far away in our lives, earlier in our lives. And, there's a connection, and that gets back to relatedness. But I don't think we were necessarily being empathic or, in a way, in communicating in such a way, one-on-one, where we really kind of see the other person's position. But, don't get me wrong, I think there's lots of positive aspects with regard to the current communication. But here's another issue. I don't know about you, but I get stressed with regard to all the email messages that I need to answer. And now, again, maybe it's worthwhile distinguishing between stress and distress. Stress is good. Stress means we're working, we're getting things done. The bad word is distress. And the difference is the perception of control. So as long as we're in control, you know, I set some time aside to answer my messages and do that's stress. Good for us. But sometimes we get overwhelmed and I can't get it all done and I've got too much on my plate, then it's distress. And so that's an important distinction for people to see. And by the way, optimists, people who expect the best and work toward the best, they experience less stress than pessimists, people who are working to avoid failure. So there's a lot of concepts here that influences how we feel about situations. But again, email can be overwhelming and takes away from the interpersonal value of communication that we gain from talking to others.
Tell us more about the Actively Caring for People movement. You touched on that a little bit, but tell us more about what's behind it and what your goals are for it.
Oh, wonderful. It is a movement. Listen, we had our tragedy in 2007. And listen, after that tragedy, people were hugging each other. We were asking, are you okay? I literally got hundreds of emails from people all across the country asking me, am I okay? So what we recognized is people showed caring after. And what we need is caring before. And I'm sorry, not just caring, actively caring. I mean, we all care, but we don't necessarily act on that caring. So that's why we call it actively caring, which connects to humanistic behaviorism. Because behaviorism, acting, humanism, caring. Okay, so we started a movement. We have wristbands. We have green wristbands. They say activelycaringpeople.org. That's our website. And we started way back. Each wristband has its own identification number. Everyone's different. So when you see an act of kindness, when you see somebody doing something nice for somebody else, you take off your wristband and you give it to them as just a token of appreciation. And you have them join the movement. And then you say, look, pass it on. By the way, go to the website, activelycaringpeople.org, and report this story that we just had, the positive interaction that we had. You know, there's so much negative news. Let's report positive news. Let's report good things. And by the way, then you pass it on and you pass on this number. Every wristband has its own number. And that wristband, excuse me, on the website, you can see it travel from where you are to South Africa. This thing is really quite big, matter of fact, in South Africa. Now, that's one simple aspect of the movement. And police officers in three different states, they have blue wristbands because police like blue. And they have their own website, activelycaringpolicing.org. So community policing, we're trying to promote this, and we have a book that teaches this concept and why it's important. So not only do we teach what to do with those seven principles, we explain the research behind it in a way that they can understand and realize that this is just not common sense. If we do this right, it's going to make a difference. So if a police officer walking through town sees a positive act by a citizen, they stop and they give him a wristband. They say, hey, I really like that. Here's a token of my appreciation. Wear this wristband. I'm telling you, the citizens are so impressed. And guess what? They feel good about this relationship with a police officer. And man, do we need more of that in our country. And then, of course, the citizen is told to pass it on when they see an act of kindness. But what we're finding is that citizens don't want to give up that blue wristband.
Yeah.
They're proud of this wristband, yeah. Especially kids. And so we do have them in child sizes and adult sizes. You can buy those wristbands. You can buy them on that website, activelycaringpeople.org. You buy the green wristbands. The blue wristbands are on the police website. And it's a movement. It's a movement of getting people to recognize each other for actively caring for behavior.
Scott, our show is called Nobody Told Me, and we always like to ask our guests, what is your Nobody Told Me moment? You're somebody who has so many years of experience in behavior psychology, and you've got this amazing positive attitude, and you've had such a great influence on so many students. Like, how did you get to be this way?
Oh, well,
what's your lesson?
It was one step after the other. I must say that I'm inspired by students. I mean, students who appreciate what I have to teach.
Well, Scott, we thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Again, the website that he was talking about is activelycaringpeople.org and also activelycaringpolicing.org. And our guest has been E. Scott Geller, a behavioral psychologist and alumni distinguished professor of psychology at Virginia Tech. Again, we thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you all so much. Appreciate it.
I'm Jan Black.
And I'm Laura Owens.
And you've been listening to Nobody Told Me.